Happy Shabbat, everyone. My pleasure to be with you. We have the full cast of characters, James, Kirk, and Larry, all with us this evening. Good to have you guys.
Good evening.
Happy Shabbat. Good to be here.
We're going to do something that we have been planning on doing for a considerable period of time. It was back while Patty was pregnant, but long before you delivered. And so a combination of things has put this off. But you did some research on the Book of Enoch, JB, and you sent us a copy of your research. And so Kirk and Larry, we have all read it. And so what we'd like to do is to let you walk us through it. And for those who might wonder why we would take a break from the 91st Psalm, which we're going to return to review Enoch, is twofold. One is that we are routinely accosted by those who say we are ignorant, satanic, stupid, illiterate, because we celebrate Pesach, Matzah, and Bikurim based upon the presentation of the dating, the timing of those things as it's presented in the Torah, where Yahweh gives us instructions as to how to choose the dates that we celebrate these events. And because Yahweh does not provide us with precision in this regard, it has to be a thoughtful process, and you don't ever want to get dogmatic about it, and it's not like you want to set it on a calendar years in advance. It's all about considering what he said, thinking it through, and making the best judgment you can with the information he's provided. And he provided more than we need to understand the purpose of these events, and I know we should meet with him, but not enough to be dogmatic about the timing. Now, the people who love Enoch say, oh, that's not true. And Enoch presents a calendar. Now, the calendar in Enoch makes a mess of the Shabbat, but nonetheless, there is a calendar in Enoch, and if you were just to say, well, you know, Enoch was a hell of a guy. You know, Enoch's with Yahweh. Yahweh loves Enoch, so if Enoch wrote it, wow, you know, it's got to be scripture. And because this is the calendar, oh, that's the answer. Now, of course, the problems are that Enoch was written in the second or third century BCE. That's long after Yahweh stopped revealing himself through prophets. The last of the prophets was Malachi. And
Enoch was gone.
Yeah, and the biggest problem, of course, is that Enoch was gone long before the flood. And so Enoch was, you know, had been gone almost 4,000 years by this time. So we're, and we'll let you then go into the other issues, but the book was not authored by Enoch. To suggest that a book that was first available in the 2nd century BCE is the only way to ascertain Yahweh's calendar is to say that no one celebrated Pesach and that God was just kidding when he established the timing for Pesach during the Exodus. And thereafter, when Hezekiah, for example, wanted to bring back the celebration of Pesach, and he said, I need a couple of weeks to get our act together, he was just guessing because the book that would give him the means to ascertain the correct timing was 500 years later. So there's some, just on the surface of it, some preposterous notion.
Well, I mean, that does represent a kind of a problem, you know, and then you've got the other attack from the lunar Shabbat. I guess you go crazy staring at the moon or whatever it is, but you know, you got the loony Shabbat people, which are just outrageously stupid, and by doing so, you know, people that don't understand the Yobel and understand timing and understand that you can't be skipping days. Thus, you're skipping decades or thousands of years or whatever you're doing, because because the 7 days represents, you know, each one represents 1,000 years, you know, to get you to Sukkah.
Yeah.
And, you know, there is no real time disappearing anywhere in there. Of course, if you're foolish and you're stupid and you're pigheaded, then you start telling people.
Now, I understand, Larry, that there is a fellow who has written a number of books on this who is really charismatic, and that lots of people are really wowed by what has to be a whole lot of half truths, because if I'm of the conclusion that you could prove anything you wanted to if you're willing to take things out of context and you don't view the whole cloth. And the problem with the Enoch calendar is you have to remove the calendar from the rest of Enoch, and then you have to disregard the fact that would have meant that no one knew how to date anything prior to the 2nd century BCE, and at that time, God wasn't even communicating with his people. So that
you would also have to disregard the Yobel, wouldn't you? I mean, you really would.
Yeah,
you'd have to disregard that because everything follows in perfect order, and that seventh day of rest means exactly. You remember we got the email from the fellow that was thinking, well, this must be day 8 because he's not understanding that Yah was speaking past, present, and future all at basically the same time. He wasn't getting that, but the seventh day of rest comes at year 6000. Simple as that.
Right. Right, yeah. The seventh day of rest begins in year 6,000. Yeah, runs to 7,000. Yeah, on the eighth day begins year 7,000. Yeah, is when the eighth day begins. We are not there, but just because we are not there doesn't mean that Yahweh hasn't already seen it. Can talk about it. Now, I personally do not think. This is just conjecture here, since we just mentioned the eighth day. I don't think Yahweh has envisioned what happens even in the new six-dimensional realm that he's going to create on the eighth day. Well, Yahweh cannot see his own future in the seventh dimension. The eighth day is a celebration in the seventh dimension of what he is going to create in six dimensions. And so he could, if he wished to, see what he is going to create in the eighth day in six dimensions. But I strongly suspect he's chosen not to. I think he wants to experience it along with us.
Well put. But again, this would throw the Yobel off. I mean, it would throw the Yobel off because counting 7 days and the seventh day of rest means exactly that. And I'm just, there was no time disappearing in the creation account that I'm aware of. And you would have to have time disappearing because the lunar Shabbat, you have to have time disappear. You have to have days disappear.
Well, what you don't have is you have a, the lunar month is not 28 days. It would have to be 28 days for there to be a regular progression of 7 days a week to celebrate the Shabbat. And because the lunar phase is 29.5 days, you have a day and a half uncounted for every month. Now,
don't you think if that had been Yahweh's intent, he could have made the lunar cycle 28 days exactly?
I think if Yahweh wanted in the Torah, James, to tell us precisely so that there was no chance of error, exactly when we should celebrate, beginning the right moment and the right day every year, his Pesach.
He would have had to be more precise.
He could have done that, but he didn't. He could have done it. He didn't. So then you have to say, why didn't he? And I think there's marvelous reasons as to why he didn't. I think, Yahweh could have told us what was the most compelling part of writing Yadayah. And Yadayah, we translate what he says, but the fun part of it is coming to understand it, to see the insights, to make the connections, to understand, for example, he doesn't tell us that, hey, stupid, when I'm talking about the fourth day of creation, it really has nothing to do with the sun and the moon. It has all to do when the greater light is going to become visible for the fulfillment of the Moed. And, you know, that's what I'm talking about here. And then, you know, he could have said that and say, you know, the greater light is Yosha, and he's going to come and fulfill the first four Mikra in the fourth millennium of human history. He could have told us that Pesach is the doorway to life, and that I'm having you eat unyeasted bread during Pesach so that there is no chance that you will become immortal and not perfect at the same time. And that matzah is all about the removal of political and religious sin. He could have said that in the Exodus account. But then, what credit would we be given for engaging in a rational discussion with him? At that point, it is a lecture to people that are too stupid to figure anything out.
Yeah, isn't that like the teacher giving the answers to the test?
Yeah.
So what he could have also said, a Yobel is a Yobel, 40 Yobel is 2,000 years plus or minus a few days, depending on the moon cycle.
Right.
You know, he could have said
And he could have told us that Adam and Chawa were kicked out of the garden, and in 3968 BCE, and that the flood occurred exactly 20 Yobel later, and that 40 Yobel later is when Abraham and Yishak had a dress rehearsal for Pesach. But if he's doing that, he's not teaching us. He's simply giving us the answers. You know, there are a lot of, that's the problem I always viewed with the calculator. When they came up with the calculator and we were no longer doing multiplication in our heads and division in our heads, where we could reason our way to the answer, but we're just given the answer, people stop thinking.
Plug and chug.
Right. Yeah. So if you're a teacher and all you do is to say, I'm going to give you the answers, you're not teaching anybody anything. No one learns how to think. They don't learn the process of understanding. They don't enjoy the voyage of discovery. They're just given the answers. And if you just gave people the answers, then they're going to be like Christians with their four spiritual laws. A, B, C, D. Is that all I need to do? Okay, I'm done. Now let's go on with my miserable life.
Which one they'll be to be with?
I don't want to spend eternity with somebody that thinks I'm so stupid that I'm just going to give you the answers because it's for damn sure you couldn't figure anything out. No, the whole part of it that's fun is figuring it out.
Glad God gives us a little more credit than that.
He does.
Well, anyway, JB, I got to tell you, I love this. A guy that's gone is hanging out on the earth all the time. That's another thing we have to believe. It's sort of like God being everywhere when he's, you know, he's got messengers, you know, because he's
on the earth. He wasn't hanging out on earth. He was hanging out at the end of the earth.
Oh, yeah.
The people were traveling all the way to the end of the earth to see him.
Of course, the biggest issue. I mean, the two biggest issues with Enoch, let's go through it from a systematic point of view. The two biggest issues is that Enoch's participation in and the presentation of the flood contradicts what Yahweh had to say, and so that's a real problem. The second aspect of Enoch that is a serious problem is that it's fanciful presentation of things that are both historical or scientific are ridiculous. They're just blatantly untrue. I mean, it was written by somebody who had all of the intellect of Muhammad.
Mm-hmm.
It's just stupid from beginning to end. So it says if Yahweh authored this, then he had a senior moment. You know, it's pathetic.
Well, I'm with that. I mean, let's get on with it. I mean, you know, you got the wind blowing the stars around and all the rest. I mean, a giant doorway, and if he's angry, he's blowing harder or whatever it is. It's just, it's bizarre. It begins to sound like a Quran to me. It's so ridiculous. Yeah,
it does. There's huge amounts of this that read just like the Quran. And the Quran is the dumbest book ever written. So the Book of Enoch is claimed to have exclusive, important, and necessary knowledge, many claim. They claim that it's being left out of the biblical canon is a conspiracy to lead people away from these essential truths. It is said that Enoch alone was given an accurate calendar on which to base the festivals and the Shabbat. So, is it true? Did Yahweh, J.B., provide us with a test to determine whether or not something was inspired?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Find it in the body, don't we? Yeah.
Yep.
18th chapter begins, "Surely a person who proclaims a message on behalf of a deity, who oversteps their bounds and speaks presumptuously and contemptuously, for the express person of conveying a statement in my name, which accordingly I have not expressly appointed, taught, guided, nor entirely directed him to speak, and who speaks in the name of other gods, indeed, then that prophet, he is deadly." So let's just start with that. Was the author of Enoch Enoch?
No.
Is there any possibility?
We don't know who wrote it. There's a chance that the guy may have been named Enoch, but it's not Enoch that it claims to be.
But the Enoch that is presented is the Enoch of Barashith.
Yeah.
Did the Enoch of Barashith write Enoch?
No.
Impossible.
Impossible, right? Absolutely impossible. So the person who is writing presumptuously. Because he's pretending to be the Enoch of Barashith. So that's about as presumptuous as you could get. Did Yosha ever quote Enoch?
No,
he didn't, did he? No, is there...
I think he's quoted in two of Paulos' letters or something. I don't know.
Enoch is mentioned, I think, in the book of Jude. I think there's a reference to Enoch. But that's digging pretty deep. All right, so...
That's a good reason to push that book right out the window along with Paul's
letters.
It is.
Right. All right, so that's the first test, is that person speaking in the name of God, and Enoch purports to do that. Does it convey what Yahweh has taught and appointed? No, it does not.
Nope.
Is the person presumptuous? So Enoch fails that first codicil. Then it goes on to say, and if you actually say in your heart, how shall we actually and consistently know accordingly if the statement which he speaks or writes is not Yahweh's? So, if you want to know about Enoch, here's the test. If that which is deliberately spoken over time by one who proclaims the message in Yahweh's name is not literally and consistently present and established and does not actually come to be, the message which he himself has deliberately spoken to influence is not Yahweh's. You know, it's interesting here that, and this is the part of it that was so eye-opening for me. There's two verbs back-to-back, Haya and Bo. Haya means exists, was, is, and will be. Bo means come or come into existence, to arrive. So what you have here is a realization, and this took me a while before I finally grasped this. When Yahweh speaks a prophecy, it isn't just predicting the future. Yahweh's view of time is that time simply is. So when he speaks a prophecy, it could be something that happened in the past. The creation account is prophetic. It can be something that happened to Noah. You know, the Torah didn't exist until, you know, more than 1,000 years after Noah. Still prophecy. So from Yahweh's perspective, what he talks about the Rome doing to Israel, now in our past, but in the prophet's future, is as much prophecy as him talking about the fall of Damascus as is the story of Noah. So what he is saying here is that if you're going to claim to speak for Yahweh, then you have to be precisely accurate throughout all time. So if you present something that historically is invalid, you're disqualified. It's not just that you have to predict the future and be right 100% of the time in predicting the future. You have to get every statement you make about the past correct.
In the present as well.
Right. And so if you look at Enoch, just the issue of the three-quarter of a mile tall people. I don't think he got that one right.
Well, just so you know, I brought that up to clowns before, and the clowns will say, well, that's just a misprint. That's just a scribal error. You know, they back up on that one, by the way, just so you know.
Okay. So they're willing. We don't really have any scribal errors that I'm aware of in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms. The scribes did their best to get it right. Until the Masoretes, long years later. But, the Dead Sea Scrolls, they're making an honest attempt to get it right. Okay. So, the history, since we know for certain that the Bereshit account is accurate regarding the flood, and we know it's accurate, A, because it's contained in a book that Yahweh proves his authorship, and proves his reliability, but also because every aspect of the flood story has the ability to be shown to be true and correct. Every aspect of it, down to the smallest details. Does the flood story in Enoch confirm or disagree with the flood story as it's presented in Bereshit?
Very
different, right?
Very different, right? Yes.
So, since Yahweh proves the credibility of his story and the fact that Enoch's story is different, then Enoch is a false prophet. The book of Enoch was not besmirched the real man, but the man who wrote it.
Unlike the Bereshit account, which makes it clear the flood was regional, the Enoch account has a worldwide flood, which we know historically is impossible.
Now, were there
scientifically
were virtually every area of the world at one point or another flooded?
Yeah.
There's times where there's been floods in South America, there's times there's been floods in North America, there's times there's been floods in Europe. But the flood that is the Enoch flood, it was only in Mesopotamia. It went up from the mouth of the Tigris and Euphrates River all the way up to the Black Sea, poured out through the Bosphorus Straits. That was it. It wiped out mankind within the Sama, and that is all there is to it. I don't know how many of you have seen Roy's most recent piece on the Nesama and how it's passed on.
Yes.
And where it might reside in the genome and why it isn't immediately identifiable by design in the genome and how it could be a recessive gene, which would explain a lot of the human behavior that we witness today.
Yeah. Good stuff.
It's really, really fascinating stuff. Okay, so he fails the first one. Now, on the prophecies of Enoch, JB, because there are a lot of prophecies, because he's speaking about the end of the world. Is there any part of the Enoch prophecies that are credible?
There's a handful that line up. You can tell it was literally just lifted straight out of other prophets.
No, well, then that doesn't count.
It's like almost word for word something that Yahshayah has said.
Okay. Well, you know, if I predict
other prophecies, those prophecies that completely contradict those prophecies.
Would I be given credit for being a prophet if I say that Damascus is going to ultimately fall and become a heap of ruins?
No.
If I were to be a prophet, if I were to say that Israel's going to be thinned at the waist?
No.
So if you're reporting on what a prophet said, that doesn't qualify. It's not a bad thing to do, but it doesn't qualify.
Yeah.
So in arrogance and presumptuousness, the prophet has spoken and written. You should not respect or revere him. So therefore, the test is the person claiming to be a prophet? Yes. Enoch's books claims to be a prophet. Does the person overstep their bounds, acting presumptuously? Yes, since the real Enoch didn't write it. Absolutely. Taking liberties? Absolutely. I mean, it's the person wrote in the name of Enoch only to get credit to a book that otherwise would have been discarded as dribble. Does the person openly and publicly preach to others, communicating their message in the name of God? Absolutely. Is the person's message inconsistent with what God has instructed? And does the message conflict with what God has constituted? In a thousand ways. So does the person speak in the names of other gods other than Yahweh? I'm not really sure he violates point five, does he?
It's hard to tell because all we have available is Nicholas copies. There were you know, copies found in the Dead Sea Scrolls, but they're not available. So, you know, it does use Lord prolifically, but that could also be just the same case as every other translation, where maybe he wrote Yah and they translated it as Lord. We can't know. So that one's kind of hard to say.
Yeah, like the Dead Sea Bible does not have all the Dead Sea Scrolls Bible says of Enoch is that it was it's a fraud, that it was compiled in the 2nd century BCE, and that it was common in that period for people to write under the name of famous personages of the past for the express purpose of garnering more attention to their work than they would achieve under their own name.
They call that using a pseudonym.
There's actually a fancy name for it, but
pseudography or something along those lines.
Yeah,
where it's like pseudo biography.
Yeah, you know, it's one thing to use a pseudonym. For example, I've written under the name Yada. I'm not trying to fool anybody. It's just a name that I picked to write so that me as an individual would become as irrelevant as possible. So. That's a pseudonym that doesn't do any harm. In fact, it has a productive purpose. If I were to write under the name of Yahusha, now that would be a problem.
Yeah.
So you have to.
I understand that too. I understand that too. I'm just saying he lifted a name. He's not using his real name, unless, as JB said, he was accidentally had the name Enoch, which is not likely, but. Maybe.
He's still a big fraud writing it the way he's writing it, even if it's
true. Yeah, sure. Of course.
Yeah.
Correct. So let's look at some of the things in it. 9:3 is the first line. You cite 7:6 is the first thing that you cite, and just read the paragraph that it's in, JB, for you. It says in. And you're speaking of, can we infer that there are no social beings since one has spent almost 6,000 years alone guarding the entry to Eden? And you say, this is not the case, however, in the Book of Enoch, which devotes several chapters to the inner workings and social going-ons of the Malach, the messengers. This includes some 200 of them coming to Earth to take wives to father children. Now,
that's a trick.
That's a heck of a trip for a spiritual being. And what did Yahusha say about when we become spiritual beings in heaven? When he was asked, you know, whose wife is somebody going to belong to? He says, there's no marriage in heaven. No. So, they swear oaths. What does Yahusha say about swearing oaths?
Don't make a place.
Don't do it.
Right. Binding curses to one another. Yahweh doesn't want us to issue curses either. Their women give birth to giants. Is there any indication whatsoever in the fossil record anywhere to be found in the world of giants?
No,
particularly. These would be beings that would have lived within the last 6,000 years.
There's only on FB. There's proof.
11 inches.
No, they're only on FB. Mm-hmm. Proof because they have what's called Photoshop, And see these pictures of guys with shovels, and there'll be a head bigger than the both of them and stuff like that. But even then, this head wouldn't be big enough based on the height of these guys. I mean,
These guys would be 3/4 mile tall. I don't know how big the head is with a 3/4 mile tall, but you know, it's still got to be in the range of 1,000 feet.
Yeah, this head's way too small. The ones I've seen photoshopped, you know, but.
If you're standing by a head that's 1,000 feet is 10 football fields.
Yeah, right. I mean, this is nowhere near that big. And, you know, I've had people when I'm discussing this that, you know, I mean, that would be, you know, like front page of news everywhere. I've had people go into how the Smithsonian Institute of all places is hiding it. Saying that the Smithsonian.
Can you imagine?
They're hiding
100 foot. Forget about 1,000 foot. Can you imagine 100 foot? Can you imagine a 10-foot head?
No.
Can you imagine a 5-foot head?
No, and whoever found it would
be extremely...
How about
a 4-foot head?
A
3-foot head?
They would be extremely wealthy. I mean, just for finding this thing, their name would be in lights. They would.
Can you imagine finding a fossil of a 2-foot tall head? How remarkably different that would be, a 2-foot tall head.
Right.
I mean, it would be in the front page of every newspaper in the world.
That's right.
For weeks. Finding a 2-foot tall head, much less a 5, 10, 20, 50, 100, 500, close to 1,000. No. According to Enoch 7-6, this went on to the point where the earth, not the people of the earth, but the earth continued to complain about them. You know, the earth complaining, that's right out of the Quran.
Yeah, the
in the Quran, the earth complains, the moon complains, the stars complain, everybody's complaining all the time. And
you know, the talking
in the Quran. Okay, so the earth complained about them. One particular messenger is said to have taught man how to make swords, daggers, shields, and breastplates. Never mind that we have evidence of daggers existing in the Neolithic age, some 4,200 years prior. Oh, well. Okay. Apparently, this was all going on, Yahweh did not have a clue. What does 9-3 say, JB?
And now to you, O holy ones of heaven, the souls of men complain, saying, bring our complaint before the Most High. So decide for yourself.
If you have to bring the complaint to the Most High, then the Most High doesn't have any idea what's going on.
Well, this goes back to the same religious notion we see in a lot of places with having to have intercessors between heaven and earth, and man and God. Man can't talk to God straight. They have to have someone intercess on their behalf. Very Catholic notion.
Yes. So then you write that in the 10th chapter of Enoch 1, that you found something rather interesting. In the 10th chapter, we get a retelling of sorts of the flood account. Now, we were mentioning that. Why is this interesting, we may wonder? Well, the fact is that Enoch was taken by Yah before or after the flood?
Well,
way before.
Yeah, about 60 years before Noah was even born, right? And Noah was, 569? Isn't that the age of Noah when he was instructed to build the ark?
He was instructed to build the ark.
Yeah, so we're talking about 630 years, right?
Yep.
So Enoch was taken by God 630 years before Noah was instructed to build the ark. And yet, Enoch is presented as the primary character in the flood story.
Yeah, he plays.
Now, how is that possible? Gone from the earth.
Well, the Torah would have to be wrong. The Torah would have
630 years prior to the flood, and he's was taken 60 years before Noah was even born. And Noah was 569 before he was instructed to build the ark, and yet he's the dominant character in the flood story, according to the book of Enoch. Well, you got to be absolutely stark raving mad. And you think that Yahweh, who speaks in first person to Noah, and they have a conversation in first person, that really isn't true, that instead Yahweh didn't even use a malach. He didn't use Gabriel. He didn't use any one of his Moloch. He instead said, hey, Enoch, I know I took you from the earth, but could you go back down there? Some things are really bothering me. I think you're the guy, so could you go find somebody and you know, I'm going to turn it over to you. You figure out what you want. And by the way, when you're all done with this, I want you to create a rainbow because I really think rainbows are cool. And there's an asteroid hanging out there, Enoch. Maybe you could, on your way down, deflect it so that it hits just at the right time.
Really
the whole thing is just...
Pictures? I mean,
I don't
really?
Think most people who cite the Book of Enoch have ever read it beginning to end. I think they look at the, you know, they read an article that shows them information, you know, the calendar and the, you know, the Sabbath is the thing most people bring up. I think they read, you know, sections and snippets and verses from that, and that's all they know from Enoch. I don't think there's anyone who could possibly have read this beginning to end actually believes this stuff.
So there was a messenger whose name only appears in the Book of Enoch that was sent to warn Noah. It, what
There's
is that
a lot of
those. Name?
They name a lot of the different messengers. This one was Arsilayur. I'm guessing on the pronunciation.
He was a real arse. Okay, so there's also this part where God sends forth his messengers to restore the earth. Now, I don't know why they're restoring the earth. This, why don't you share 10:9 with us in the Book of Enoch, 10:9.
And the Lord said to Gabriel, proceed against the bastards and the reprobates, and against the sons of fornicators, and destroy the sons of fornicators and the sons of the watchers from amongst men, and send them out and send them against one another, and let them destroy themselves in battle, for they will not have length of days. And
wow!
Enoch,
wow!
With angels.
Wow!
Now, by the way,
I thought
Lord,
the flood was
here is written L O R D in the lowercase, isn't it?
Yes.
You know what the custom is in translation? If
it's
Lord is replacing Yahweh, it's written in all caps. If Lord is replacing Edon or Adon, it's written as it appears in Enoch. That is the custom of. Every English translator I've ever seen. So the fact is capital L, lowercase O-R-D, means that it was written Lord. It's Adon, or Baal. One of the things we don't have in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms that I'm aware of is Yahweh instructions to Gabriel. We have Gabriel communicating to Daniel, for example. We have Gabriel communicating to Miriam. But we aren't given Yahweh's instructions to Gabriel because that would be superfluous. All we care is what Gabriel told Daniel, for example.
Yeah,
you know, why even have Daniel? I mean, there's no purpose to Daniel, for example, if Yahweh revealed what he told his Moloch. So there's no purpose in an Enoch if Yahweh wanted to reveal what he communicated to Gabriel. What you're doing is you're working around man. You're eliminating the need for a human individual to serve as Yahweh's messenger and prophet. It's not the way God works. So just the fact that it says, and the Lord spoke to Gabriel, that's not the way that this goes. Now, proceed against the bastards. Does Yahweh any place else say he wants us to proceed against bastards?
No.
I've studied a lot of Hebrew. I've never seen the word reprobate. I've never seen a word that could be translated reprobate. And you know, one of the things that's interesting is that in Pauline Christianity, there's a whole fixation on fornication. I haven't found it in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms. You know, my sense is, I mean, I could be really wrong here, so I'm not claiming to be right. I'm just going to tell you the conclusion that I have drawn is that Yahweh rather likes the design of the human anatomy. And that he designed it so that it would be, that man would be attractive to woman and woman would be attractive to man. And when we were all in the garden together, we were stark naked. And it was no problem. And that Yahweh has an issue with perversions of sexuality. He doesn't have an issue with us having sex, but when we do it with family members, when we do it with the same sex, and when we do it with animals, he's got an issue with that. But this whole fornication thing, I don't think it matters.
The only issue comes when we pervert the family model.
Correct. And we're not perverting the family model when we're being well. Look at Dode had a harem, didn't he?
Yeah.
Okay. Was Dode ever lambasted, criticized by Yahweh for having a harem?
Nope.
Nope. He was only criticized when he screwed up the family model by A, being disingenuous with his general, with trying to steal another man's wife, and then committing adultery.
That's right.
That bothered Yahweh. He had a good man killed so that he could have sex with his wife. And Yahweh didn't reject Dode for doing so, but he said, you know, that was a bad thing to do. But he never once criticized Dode having a harem. Do you think that Dode had a harem and didn't have fornicate with him?
Yaakov married father children with both of them and their handmaidens.
Right.
And God didn't seem to care.
Didn't seem to care.
Yeah.
So I've always viewed this whole issue with sexuality as being you can't do that. That was bad. You're bad.
It's a straw man. It's a straw man. It's a religious nonsense.
Right.
Uptight.
Right.
I get
right.
so
right.
tired
So this has
of
the
it.
Religious nonsense in it today. That God wants to proceed against the sons of the fornicators. By the way, he doesn't want to proceed against the fornicators, but the sons of the fornicators.
yeah, that's pretty bad, isn't it?
Yeah. sons of the fornicators.
Yeah, what did the bastards do? They had no control over their parents' actions.
So when Yahweh speaks of watching, and there's a lot of prophetic testimony about watchers. And he talks about, like, for example, in Yashayah, he says, you know, Yisrael's going to be destroyed, but I'm still going to keep my signposts along the way, and I'm going to keep a shelter for those who are watchers, for those who are keeping guard, who are observant. Now, they're going to be their shed to spend the night. You know, is going to be temporary, and it's going to be in the midst of a very thorny garden filled with all sorts of chaff. But I'm going to keep it there. I want somebody who's observant. I want somebody who is paying attention in Israel. And so when God speaks of watchers, he likes them. That's a positive thing. That's an observant person. So
we talked about it today, remember?
Yeah, absolutely. Do you think that Yahweh was about to tell Gabriel and his malach to destroy those who are observant?
Yeah, well, you know what they do here.
Enoch, watchers is a term that is synonymous with angels. So when it says
the
sons of angels.
Malach. And it's funny, you can't destroy malach, right? You can't destroy an infinite being. You can't do it, right? There's BS. I mean, you can't do that. I mean, you can't. It just can't be done.
Gabriel to proceed against them and destroy them, and then he says, let them destroy one another in battle. Which one is it?
Yeah.
Well, not only that, why do you have the flood? I mean, if you've got them destroying each other, there is no purpose of the flood then, because you got them all gone. It's just
right.
Stupid.
So what Yahweh here is wants to have happen is to have battles. And he wants destruction. Why did Yahweh tell us that he arranged for the flood?
Because men were destructive.
Right. Of the destruction.
Right. But men were destructive. And they were killing. They were vicious. And because man was vicious and destructive and destroying life, that's why he had the flood. And yet, the order here is for God to perpetrate the very thing that he said that he was causing, perpetrating the flood to eliminate. Wow. Then it says, 10:16, destroy all wrong from the face of the earth. Every evil work will cease. Did that happen?
No.
Well, they're slow. The Moloch are slow.
Yeah, well, let's look at of the Mayans. Did they rip out the hearts of their victims?
Yeah, got to see how they're still breathing.
Did the Aztecs do it? Yeah. How about the Incas? Was there any point where Rome was engaged in anything that wasn't evil? How about Sparta? The Carthaginians? Have you ever read anything about Alexander the Great? Do you think there was some evil there?
Oh,
I mean, God describes Babylon as evil. Babylon followed the flood. So, was every evil work ceased?
No.
Hell?
Not by a long shot.
No. Funny, and by the way, Yahweh could not have evil cease. Because if evil was eradicated, there'd be no more choice. You know, I wrote something today. It's somewhat related to this tangentially. So this is just a thought. Was, you know, I was always wondered, why did Yahweh create Chawa? Right. Yahweh was content having a relationship with Adam. Why did he create Chawa? You know what my thought is? Why he did it?
Maybe Adam didn't want
to. He did it because what he didn't want is for Adam to choose to be with him by default. To choose to be with him because he was bored. To choose to be with him because he was lonely.
He's the only game in town.
Yeah, the only game in town is either I sit here and I'm completely bored out of my mind, or I hang with Yahweh. That's my only option. So, okay, you know, he wants to go and play the animal game, so I'm going to go do that, you know. I think Chawa's primary purpose was to create a companion for Adam so that Adam had an alternative to Yahweh. Now, that doesn't make Chawa bad. It just means that God said, you know, I don't want to be chosen by default. I don't want to be chosen because you're lonely or bored. I want you to, if you want to spend time with me because you really enjoy my company, then great. But if you don't,
you know that. But he also made them want this. He also probably wanted to, would Adam include Chawa in that relationship too? I mean, I think
correct.
That. I mean, because
and their children. And their children.
Yeah.
Correct. Yeah, if it works the way that he wanted it to happen, it would he'd have a male and a female perspective on his creation, and a child's perspective, and a parent's perspective, and all of a sudden everyone that would be part of eternity with him would have the perspective of a parent, the perspective of a child, and the perspective of what family is like if he created Chawa. It empowers the quality of the relationship because it elevates our experience level so that we have more to contribute. Yeah.
Let me ask
all
a question.
Sure.
When did this group of people stop having an Nesama gene?
When did what group of people?
Well, you have Adam and Chawa. They both have an Nesama, right?
Uh-huh.
And then somewhere along the line, they stop having, everyone that marries stops having, some of them stop having or have a recessive gene.
I think what Roy was suggesting is that the Nisama, which is our ability to think, our ability to process information and to be judgmental, to be discerning, to be moral, to differentiate between right and wrong, good and bad, and therefore to know who Yahweh is, understand what he's offering, and be able to respond rationally, but more importantly, to be able to engage in rational discourse. So that's who, in fact, one of the things in Yashayah, in the first chapter, Yahweh says, please, what I really want is for us to go take a walk together and have a rational discussion.
Mm-hmm.
That's really all God wants. Let's go walk through the universe together and have a rational discussion. So the Nisama enables that. And so what Roy was proposing, and I read his letter this morning, and I'm sure I'll get some of this wrong, but that our DNA has what's called junk DNA. There's lots of it, which we just don't know what it all does.
Right.
And what he thinks is that hidden in the DNA strand is the capacity for a Nisama, and that it's not obvious what that particular strand does, because if man recognized it, we would manipulate it. But that it could be passed on as a recessive gene.
Yeah.
Or it could be passed on as a dominant gene. And he says, no, if it's a recessive gene, then, two people that were to marry and have kids, if one had a Nisama and the other one did not, as a recessive gene, their children are not going to have a Nisama. But two people with a Nisama would marry, their children are going to have an Nisama. So if you look at the Yahweh's chosen people, and it would kind of help explain why such a high percentage of scientific discovery comes by way of Yehudim, and why those who are hugely opposed to Yisrael, Muslims, for example, have such a low propensity to be reasonable. There is this possibility that it would be a recessive gene, and that there are many people without an Nisama.
Well, you think about it in terms of genetics like that. We're told that the descendants of Adam bred with these humans that were on the earth that didn't have an Nisama,
right.
And that went on up until the flood. Then we wiped it out. So that in that region. So now you're starting
right.
with a very small group, all of whom have an Nisama, and you're building the family from that. So
correct.
The likelihood that Noah's children and grandchildren would have an Nisama is exponentially
right.
high, and so on,
correct.
Until they
yes.
started getting out and going down into Egypt and spreading out around the world.
Or
and
Europe
is
someplace
with
where
these
they could
humans
have
that don't have a Nisama. But
correct.
By then, the gene pool was strong enough that it could withstand that.
Right.
Whereas
right.
early on, coming just from Adam, the gene pool the gene wasn't strong enough to withstand that.
Right. Yeah, but anyway, it's an interesting thought about the possibility of how the Nisama is passed on and whether or not a significant percentage of people have it today and why it is that we appear to have been dumbed down. I can tell you, having recently traveled to your state, James, to Texas, and I spent 4 or 5 days running errands for my son, I have never encountered in my life so many stupid people. Rude and just oblivious
arrogant.
People. But just with nothing going on upstairs.
Mm-hmm.
It was frightening. I mean, it was really frightening how little capacity for rational and moral thought exists in the state of Texas. I was just horrified. I left there wanting to leave so bad I could hardly even contain myself. And the place where you really see how people process information and what their sense of judgment is of right and wrong is when you drive. Because you're encountering people all the time. And it's stunning how stupid people are, how they have lost the ability to be observant and to process the information around them in a reasonable way. So I think there really is a possibility. percentage of people thought of Masoma.
Well, it explains a lot to me. I agree with it.
Yeah. So then 10:21 says that, and the sons of men shall be righteous, and the nations shall serve and bless me and shall worship me.
Wrong.
Wow. Way out of Torah there.
Now, the sons of men aren't righteous. The sons of the covenant are righteous. And by the way, it's the sons and the daughters of the covenant that are righteous.
Yeah.
And nations, that which is typically from Goy and Goyim in the plural, do not serve Yahweh.
No.
In fact, Yahweh speaks against the Goy, which is the nations, the Hebrew word for nations, routinely. And nobody worships Yahweh. They worship the Lord. They don't worship Yahweh. He doesn't want to be worshipped. Yeah, so every bit of that's wrong. Now, we have none of Enoch in Hebrew, so we are reliant on other things. I understand, and this was my understanding anyway, is that the oldest copies are in Aramaic. Is that true?
Actually, the oldest copies we have are in an Ethiopian language called...
I thought there were some copies of Enoch amongst the Dead Sea Scrolls in Qumran.
Yeah.
Well, there weren't copies. There were just a couple smatterings.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah, there are. Those are in Aramaic.
The oldest fragments are in Aramaic, but the oldest actual extant book that you could make something out of, like this is being translated from an Ethiopian dialect.
You'd have no hope with what's in the Dead Sea Scrolls of coming up with any kind of context, understanding of what's going on.
Okay.
It's a verse here, a verse there.
Okay.
It's the Ethiopic Apocryphus of Enoch, that's
right.
What they call it.
Wow.
Well, the footnote on the Dead Sea Scrolls.
So 12.
It said what,
sir?
I'm sorry.
Oh, it's the Ethiopic Apocalyptic of Enoch. It's the footnote of what they're calling it in the Dead Sea Scrolls.
Ethiopic Apocalyptic. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Got it.
Okay, well, what other part of Yahweh's revelation comes to us by way of Ethiopian?
None.
Okay. And I, Enoch, so this is Enoch speaking in first person, was blessing the great Lord and the King of Eternity, Lord, lowercase, O-R-D. So this is Satan. I was blessing the great Satan, the King of Eternity. And behold, the watchers called to me, Enoch the scribe, and said to me, was Enoch the scribe?
Not by knowledge.
No, so this
is told in first piece that he wrote anything. We're not even told that he was
first person in him. Yeah, first person Enoch. No, I don't think so. Before we move on to some more differences you wrote, I would like to note a tonal difference, which is clear. I spoke earlier of how little we are told about the messengers of Yahweh, and there's a reason for that. They're not important to the story of Yahweh's plan and intention with his Torah. Yahweh's Torah exists for the sole purpose of introducing us to Yahweh and his plan. So outside of the role, the Malacca play, or the Malak, but Malacca would be the feminine, we do not need to know anything about them because they are irrelevant to our story. Enoch, on the other hand, focuses heavily on the activity and the nature of the Malak, which is the only book that does so. And they are just busy little campers. Huge portions of the text takes place exclusively with the messengers and have nothing to do with man or man's relationship with Yahweh. That's a reason by itself to throw it away.
Right.
25:3, and he answered me, saying, this high mountain which you saw, whose summit is like the throne of the Lord, is the throne where the Holy and Great One, the Lord of Glory, the Eternal King, will sit when he comes down to visit the earth for good.
Meaning
that mountain
forever. Meaning forever.
Where's that mountain? Where is the mountain that is the throne of God?
That'd be Moriah.
But the,
no, this,
this
means,
is talking
this is
about
the
summit
is
like
a throne.
Is the summit of Mount Moriah like a throne?
No.
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 No. It is not like a throne, is it? See, is there
no.
any mountain that's like a throne? The
no.
summit of any mountain?
That's
is
what
like
I'm aware of.
No.
No.
Is the, and would it, would the mountain have to be in Israel?
Yeah, it would have to be.
Are there any mountains in Israel that are more prominent than the big three? Olives, Moriah, and Zion.
No.
No.
Not that.
Does God speak of any mountains other than those three?
No.
Is God's throne, when he comes to earth to reside, where is it going to be?
In Jerusalem.
Mount Moriah.
Yeah.
Right where his temple
is. Moriah.
That's right. Yeah. Mount Moriah. So can there be another mountain that serves as the throne of God? No.
No.
And by the way here, this did say the Lord of Glory, or Lord is written capital L, lowercase O-R-D. And so since it's the Lord of Glory there, that means that every reference that says Lord here is actually Lord. So this was
yeah, and holy
in the names of
and holy
God.
They write. Holy they write.
Yeah.
Now that might just be again one of these holy the consort of Krishna.
Could have been holy could have been Kodesh and then
well no, it couldn't have been because it wasn't written in Hebrew.
True.
Okay.
No, I think over in Ethiopia, they're still running around having holy days because they play religious dress up and follow crosses around.
Yeah. Can I ask you a question, JB? Is there any time when Yah is going to come to visit the earth for good, where he's going to remain?
No.
The longest he's going to stay is how long? How long is he going to stay? The longest he's going to stay, 1,000 years, right? And then the earth is going to be destroyed. So is there any chance that Yah is going to exist on the earth for good?
No.
So this is that is an invalid statement. Okay. The Book of Enoch presents the birth of Noah. Of course, he was born 60 years after Enoch was taken. 106th chapter, we're told that Methuselah chose a wife for his son Lamech, and she became pregnant and bore a son. Okay. So far, it's keeping with the Bereshit account. Then, what does 106, 2 and 3 say, JB?
And his body was white like snow and red like the flower of a rose. And the hair on his head was white like wool. And his eyes were beautiful. And when they opened his eyes, he made the whole house bright like the sun. So that the whole house was exceptionally bright. And when he was taken from the hand of the midwife, he opened his mouth and spoke to the Lord of Righteousness.
Yep.
Wow.
You know who the Lord of Righteousness is? That's the esteemed deceased leader of the Essenes.
Yeah, right. Yeah,
the teacher of righteousness, the Lord of Righteousness.
Wrote the DSS we're looking for or something.
Yeah. That's the leader of the Essenes, an actual man that was vying for power against the Maccabees. Okay, so that is a fairy tale. That's as much a fairy tale as Greek and Roman and Egyptian pagan mythology. Okay. By the way, is any of that mentioned in the Bereshit?
Not a word.
Would you think that in a small little region where Noah lived? You think that Yahweh would have made a mention that his eyes lit up the whole room?
No.
Do you think that would
have
drawn attention to him prior to him building the ark?
I would think it would.
Do you think that if somebody's eyes were as bright as the sun and that could speak when it was one moment old, that people would have mocked him?
God told him that a flood was coming, you'd have had 100 volunteers helping build the ark.
They would have thought he was a god.
But even if you didn't believe him, I mean, if somebody walked into this room and had eyes that were as bright as the sun, I ain't going to toy with them.
Yeah.
I tell you, I'm not going to mock them.
Well,
I don't want to be incinerated.
Can I throw something in here? One of the, what this puts me to mind of? Puts me to mind of the Quran story where Abraham is like 2 years old and he walks out of a cave after being in a cave forever and starts debating and arguing with the people of Babylon. I mean, it's the most insane proposition.
Right.
It's just another insane, nonsense story. It's just so much
catalyze people's curiosity. You know, it's a tall tale.
Yeah.
People like tall tales. It's like a tall tale like Paul Bunyan. Less credible.
Yes.
But a tall tale. Just to tease people and entertain them. You know, it's Alice in Wonderland is not a true story.
You're kidding.
Okay. So, 106.8. And when Methuselah heard the words of his son, he came to me at the ends of the earth. Why would he come to him at the end of the earth? For he heard that I was there, and he cried out, and I heard his voice, and went to him. Well, by the way, where is the end of the earth? The earth is a
round.
Yeah, it's a ball. You know, it's one of the things about a ball is there isn't an end. You can run around a ball for infinity.
Okay, don't stop until you reach the end.
Okay. But he heard I was there, and he said to me, "Behold, I am here, my son, for you have come to me." Yep.
At the end of the earth. So he was still on the flat earth theory. He was still
flat earth.
Uh-huh. Yep. And by the way, there's a bunch of that
very primitive thinking.
You two guys aren't aware of it because you're not on FB. But
I've heard about it on the radio. The flat earth.
Yeah, there's this whole group of them. They're out there, and they're the flat earth people, you know. And of course, I watch WhoDunit. So
have you ever flown on an airplane across the ocean to a place like Japan? Right.
Yes.
You know what? You know, Arnold Palmer's one of my favorite athletes. Arnold Palmer, when he first got his Learjet, one of the things he did, he flew it around the world. He took off going eastbound, and he continued to fly eastbound until he came to the place where he had started in Latrobe, Pennsylvania. So can you tell me how you can continue to fly east and end up at the same place you started unless the Earth is round? Have you ever seen a picture of the Earth from space?
Yeah. It's a great big ball.
Yeah, a great big ball.
Just bear with me a moment on this. Just bear with me. You know, I watch a lot of these whodunits, and one of them is called Missing. That's the name of the show. It's just Missing. And they never find the person. So I have a feeling, okay, that they walked up to the edge of the earth and just fell off. And that's it. And that's what I think.
You have a career in Hollywood.
No, I mean, really. I guess if you see the end of the earth.
Have you ever heard of the Around the World cruise?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I've heard of
Around the World
cruise. I've actually taken part in them.
Can you tell me what happens on the flat earth when the ocean reaches the end of it?
I have no clue.
Go to the website. They go
giant
all sorts of the links to explain how that works and how you can circumnavigate the flat earth.
Hmm.
And you don't really,
really?
You need to fear. Yo, I spent like a half hour reading through that website one day just laughing my butt off because it's just ridiculous. But they come to some of the most convoluted arguments where, how can you circumnavigate the planet if it's flat? Well, here's why. If you go east, then you're just traveling around the disk. You're not actually going in a circle around the Earth. You're traveling around the disk because the North Pole is, think of it like a record. The North Pole is the hole in the middle of the record. So if you're constantly traveling east, you're just traveling in the circle around the record. That's their argument.
Oh, no, east is a direction. It's not a circle. See, that's the problem with that.
Well,
they
say that the North Pole, because that east would change as you go, with the north always being at the center of this disk.
So there were people. I think, by the way, I think Roy's theory, and Roy never extrapolates beyond what he can demonstrate. So I'm extrapolating. And he suggested that maybe the Nisalma was a recessive gene. Boy, the evidence is pretty convincing. I mean, you really have to be stupid at this point.
I mean, yeah, maybe they pulled this out of the book again. They probably pulled it. You know, they'll do that. They'll take snippets out of something and they'll go, that right there proves it's a flat earth.
Yeah,
that right there. You know, there's people that stand on that. You know that.
So, you know, I have been.
I've seen horizons, by the way.
Craft at 50,000 feet. And you know what you can see at 50,000 feet?
Yeah, the horizon.
The earth.
You can see the whole
the curvature,
of the earth.
Curvature of the earth.
The curvature, sure. Of course you can.
Yeah, curvature of the earth.
I've seen it too.
Okay.
And by the way, I can see the sun that's 93 million miles away on a straight line. I mean, I really can. So let's say I'm standing here in Jacksonville, Florida, looking out over the ocean.
Uh-huh.
You know, I should be able to see over the Mideast from there.
You should be able to see
the
Himalayas. Right?
Yeah, I'm sure I should. Of course I should.
But I don't know
guess
where
they never.
I don't know where
horizon.
The cut is on this on the flat Earth. Where does East end and West begin?
I have no clue.
Yeah, where's the place? Where do you get to the edge?
How come nobody's ever seen the damn edge? You know, I mean, I'd want to go see it, wouldn't you? I mean, I really would. It'd be like a big deal.
Yeah,
I might
not want to get too close to it. But
I might not want to get too close if I'm in the water for fear of this giant waterfall.
I'd go fly my airplane. Yeah, I'd go fly my airplane over it.
Yeah, but
okay.
I'd like to see it.
Yeah. Another thing worth addressing is the book's use of law regards to Yahweh. Now, while this could be a translation error, it's unlikely because the book wasn't written in Hebrew, so there would have been no Torah, so it's probably law. 2:1, contemplate all events in the sky, how the lights in the sky do not change their courses. Each rises and sets in order, each at its proper time. They do not transgress their law. First of all, is it true? Do the lights in the sky not change their courses?
No, that's not true at all.
You know, that's what they would be back in the day when they were looking at the planets and the reflected lights. They were called the wanderers, and they were called the wanderers planets because of the fact they changed their courses.
Yeah, they moved around. Sure,
they moved around. Yeah, they moved around. So it's factually untrue. And that how each rises and sets in order. They actually don't rise and set. It's just that the Earth turns. They aren't moving at all.
Yeah.
But they're moving flatter because of the turn.
Yeah, the stars are not, I mean, everything is expanding. But relative to their relative motion that we watch in terms of rise and fall, that relative motion has nothing to do with them. They're not following a course. It's just that the Earth is revolving.
Well, you got another problem. You got another problem with flat Earth too, because I want to know why it's light over here and then it's dark over on the other side.
Yeah,
all at the same time.
Yeah, how is that possible if it's flat? Because the sun would either if it's flat, the amount of sunlight would always be the same no matter where you lived.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It would all be dark at the same time, and it would all be light at the same time.
Right. Correct.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess they never thought of that. Or,
yeah,
5-4.
You have not.
I'm sure they read this convoluted explanation for it.
Oh, boy. How could that
But
be?
You have not persevered in nor observed the law of the Lord, but you have transgressed and spoken proud and hard words with your unclean mouth against his majesty. You hard of heart, you will not have peace. Yah doesn't have a law. 33:3, and I saw how the stars of heaven came out, and I counted the gates out of which they came. and I wrote down all of their outlets for each one, individually according to their number, and their names according to their constellations, their positions, their times, their months, as the angel Uriel, who was with me, showed me. Do the stars come out of gates?
No. Well, this is still showing that same Earth-centric perspective of everything revolves around the Earth.
Right.
I think he was drunk, and what was happening there is he was at a horse race.
Right.
And what he's failing to tell you is that the stars are the stars of the track. They're horses coming out of gates.
Yeah, of course.
That's what's going on.
You know, talks about every star had a number.
Oh, sure.
Do you know that the number of stars, the best guess is there's somewhere around 400 billion galaxies, and there's roughly 100 billion stars in the average galaxy. When you're dealing with numbers like 400 billion times 100 billion, the thought that they were
a lot of numbers.
And that those numbers would be down. You know how long it would take for the angel Uriel to review every star by number, as this suggests?
It would take more than a lifetime. It would take a million lifetimes. Minimum.
Yeah, it would take a million lifetimes just to identify them by number. And if you had the number, let's just say that you devoted the time, I'm going to have the number of every star. So what? What gain would you have by the time you were finished? What would
nothing. You'd have nothing. You'd have nothing.
What is conveyed here? Nothing. Why? Because there's no purpose of it. It's just to create the illusion of secret knowledge.
Well, then what do you do when the stars are dead by the time you get through the count?
Oh,
you got to start all over.
Right.
They come out of the dead
stars
that
have been swallowed up by black holes. And the fact that every moment, thousands upon thousands of stars are being created.
Yeah.
And every moment,
you got a real problem.
Thousands of stars are dying.
Well, maybe Uriel is still counting.
Maybe he is. But you have to subtract as you add.
Yeah.
And he showed me everything and wrote it, and also their names he wrote down for me, and their laws and their functions. So that he wrote down the laws and the functions and the names of every star.
So
you think that there's any star that has a different function than any other star? Do you think there's any star that has a law? Think of the Torah. In the Torah, there are probably 500 to 600 names in the Torah. Torah, prophets, and Psalms. Less than 1,000 names, right? Probably less than 1,000 names. And by the time you've gone through all those 1,000 names, I mean, there are probably 500, 600, 700 names that have meaning. And after that, you know, it's just irrelevant what the names are. Can you imagine naming 100 billion stars and 400 billion galaxies and thinking, boy, this is really fun. What am I going to come up with next?
Oh, yeah, you're talking about, like, terminal boredom. I guess this
terminal
is because
boredom.
Eternity's forever. And
I think I lost count somewhere around 700 zillion trillion. Then you start over again. Where was I?
Yeah. So 3 trillion cubed.
And they transgress the law.
Yeah.
They have been promiscuous with women and commit sin with them, and they have married some of them, and they have begotten children by them.
Now, we're talking about Moloch here, right?
I think we're talking about Moloch, aren't we?
Mm-hmm, the ones that are made out of light and can't reproduce.
Yeah, thus says the Lord of Spirits. The Lord of Spirits would be Satan. This is the law and the judgment for the mighty and the kings and the exalted and for those who possess dry ground in front of the Lord of Spirits.
The Lord of Spirits.
So does Yahweh have a law and kings?
Nope.
Neither. And this is the law of the lights called the sun. is rising in the gates of heaven and towards the east, and its setting is in the western gates of heaven.
Oh, the gates.
Does the sun rise? Or is it just the relative motion of the Earth's rotation?
It appears to rise from Earth's rotation, but the sun, it's pretty much sitting there in one place.
Yeah, but these are the laws.
It's moving out, but so are we with it, so...
Is there a gate that the sun rises and a gate that the sun sets in? It's like the sun going to bed in the muddy spring in the Quran.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. We actually know that the sun, sets in a muddy spring. It's like boiling.
Can you imagine what the atheists would have done with this book had it been part of the canon?
Oh, they'd have made an ass out of all of them. I mean, it's just so stupid.
Yeah.
It's just stupid. This is stupid. And, you know, this is what I've tried to tell people. It's so ridiculous. It's just dumb. And, you know, I saw another journey.
According to this law, the moon makes a monthly journey. The moon doesn't make a monthly journey. You know, it's... That's not how moon phases work. And thus the 12 gates and the four quarters of heaven are complete, and all of their laws and all of their punishments. So there'll be punishments, I guess, for the sun, a punishment for the moon, a punishment for the stars. I have shown you, my son, the Methuselah. And Uriel showed me another law. When light is transferred to the moon, on what side it is transferred from the sun. So the light is transferred from one side of the sun, and he showed how it was transferred to one side of the moon. You know, the fact is that that's not true. Like when we see a new moon, it's because the light is now reflecting off the side of the moon that's facing away from the Earth. And we see a full moon, it's because the light is now reflected on the opposite side of the moon. So there isn't one side of the moon that has light and one side that doesn't. You know, from the right perspective, half of the moon is always illuminated. And from the right perspective, half the moon is dark. And that changes based upon the position of the moon relative to the sun. But this idea that one side is dark and one side is light and it remains that way, not true. Got it wrong again. All the time that the moon is increasing in its light, it transfers as it becomes opposite the sun until 14 days, its light is full in the sky when it is all ablaze and its light is full in the sky.
Light doesn't increase in the moment. All it is reflected.
That is correct. And, oh, by the way, the lunar cycle is not 14 days. Half the lunar cycle is not 14 days. Now, for a Shabbat, lunar Shabbat, it would have to be 14 days because 28 would be correct. But it isn't. It's 29 and a half. Oops. And now, my son, Methuselah, I have shown you everything, and the whole law of the stars of heaven is complete. I'm sorry. There are no laws of the stars. I could fill several. I mean, it just goes on and on like this. Enoch 7:2. Women are impregnated by angels, and they bore giants.
Ouch!
And... That's a bad thing. But how big are these?
Before we get into the giants, though, going back, those verses we just read through, the reason I cited all them was to show that the way the author uses law is could not possibly be Torah, at least not as Torah was meant. Torah is teaching and understanding. The way law is used there is not teaching. There is no way to look at any of those examples and say that that's a teaching. That's a way of understanding. Those are law as in law, which, that's just evidence is more the late writing of this book. This was written after man had began to form religions around usurping the Torah's authority. That's when, Torah became to mean law, which is how this author uses it.
That's a good point. That's a good point.
Stupid. It's not true. Okay, 7:2. and they became pregnant and bore large giants, and their height was 3,000 cubits. That's somewhere between 4,500 and 5,300 feet, depending on what you use for the cubit. I mean, they're darn near a mile tall. Darn near a mile tall.
And that woman bore that Florida.
I mean, what's the tallest mountain in Florida? About 18 feet?
Yeah, probably. Yeah, when there's 3 feet high, we call it Mount something down here. Yeah. That's right.
And to give that context, the tallest man on record was 8'11" and suffered horrible back problems his entire life because of his height.
Okay, so let's say it was a typo and it was really 300 cubits. Okay, so that's 450 feet.
That's still
okay.
Well, yeah, that's even
let's
like,
say that it was a typo and it was really 30 cubits. Well, 30 cubits would be 15 feet. Right? You're right. 30 cubits would be 40 feet. Would be 45 feet. Yeah, 45 feet.
Okay.
So there's no 45-foot man, there's no 450-foot man, there's no 4,500-foot man. So whether they were wrong by 10-fold, 100-fold, not a prayer.
Oh, I know. By now I'm looking for Jack's magic beans in this story. I'm serious.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, it's getting stupid.
And I saw three gates of heaven. Through each of them, north winds go out. And when they blow, there is cold hail, hoarfrost, snow, fog, and rain. So you know that wind are, because there's gates in heaven. Wind has nothing to do with the heating of the earth's surface and the fact that that warm air is less dense than cool air. And that it flows from dense to less dense, and that we also have the rotating effect of the earth. So the prevailing wind, of course, is always going to blow from west to east because of the way the earth rotates. And then beyond that, you have the uneven heating of the land and the oceans, and the differential between the heating of areas that are in the sun during the day and in the shade shadow at night. That's what causes wind. You know, it blows
it's
from high pressure to low pressure.
After all.
Oh my goodness! I mean, why would anybody think? Well, in the midst of all of this drivel, there is a calendar that we can rely on. A calendar,
look,
by the way,
that
says that a month lunar phase is 28 days.
You know, I couldn't believe that. Look, I couldn't believe the flood accounts with the cows that got scared and given birth to all kinds of different animals and all this. You know, when I read that, I mean, I put the thing down. This is just a giant fairy tale. I mean, it just sounds like somebody was on an acid trip somewhere. Really?
Oh yeah.
That's
and
to me.
From one gate, it blows for good. But when they blow through the other two gates, it is with a force that brings torment to the earth, and they blow with force. This reads again like the Quran. It is so stupid, it hurts. You have to be an absolute idiot to believe that there are gates in heaven from which wind is derived.
You'd have to be an Ethiopian, at least. And that's pretty bad, I'm going to tell you. I mean, really.
Did they have to go through the gates of heaven to get to the moon? Was that really how the moonshot worked? And if this is the case, why don't we just take the gates of heaven to Mars and we don't have to worry about the spaceship?
Be a little quicker.
Good point.
36:3. Through each of these smaller gates, the stars of heaven pass and go towards the west, and the path has been shown to them. So the stars follow a path that is shown to them out of the gates of heaven, and they obey the law. I mean,
yeah, because they are
being pulled on chariots by thousands of angels.
Well, I mean, they have eyes.
The same rot that you find in the Quran.
Uh-huh.
41:4. And there I saw closed storehouses from which the winds are distributed. So winds are stored up in a storehouse, and that's how they're distributed. And the storehouse of the hail, and the storehouse of the mist, and the storehouse of the clouds. Its cloud remained over the earth from the beginning of the world.
Yeah.
And I saw the chambers of the sun and the moon, where they go out, where they return, and the glorious return, how one is more honored than the other. That's exactly the Quran, same message. And their magnificent course, that's also the Quran. And they do not leave their course, that's another snippet in the Quran. And neither adding nor subtracting from their course, that's also in the Quran. And they keep their faith in one another, observing their oath, also in the Quran. Satan must have loved this and just said, oh, I'm just going to use it again in the Quran. We're great here. And the sun goes out and completes its journey at the command of the Lord of Spirits, and his name endures forever and ever. Oh, my. And after this is the hidden and visible path of the moon, and it travels the course of its journey. And that place, by day and by night, one stands opposite the other in front of the Lord of Spirit. And they give thanks, and they sing praises, and they do not rest, because their thanksgiving is like rest to them. This is, read right out of the Quran. In the Quran, the moon and the sun are obeying Allah. They're thanking Allah.
They argue with each other.
Oh, yeah, they're having a race.
They debate each other and all this nonsense. You know, if people are so stupid, I mean, that they really, really think things like this. You know, I think it's like, I guess it was JB that said they go read a snippet and then some guy writes some piece and it sounds feasible or something like that. But they've never sat down and honestly considered the stupidity, the abject stupidity of this book. I mean, it's insane.
43 hours anyone could have read this beginning to end.
No, and came away believing it. 43:1. And again I saw flashes of lightning and the stars of heaven. And I saw how he called them by their names, and they obeyed him. So flashes of lightning and the stars are related. And the stars obey the spirit of the Lord of the Spirits. Again, it's Quranic. And I saw the balance of righteousness and how they are weighed according to their light. So stars are weighed in a balance of righteousness according to their width of their areas and the day of their appearing and how their revolutions produce lightning. And the revolutions according to the number of the angels and how they keep their faith with one another. Stars keep their faith with one another. They have personas. They have names. They are obedient to the law, and stars are the source of lightning. How do you like them?
Yeah, that's scientifically provable. Sure. I think Ben Franklin figured that out or something. Pretty sure.
And I asked the angel who went with me and showed me what is secret. What are these? And he said to me, their likeness, the Lord of the Spirits has shown to you, these are the names of the righteous who dwell on the dry land, and they believe in the name of the Lord of Spirits forever and ever. And other things I saw concerning lightning, how some of the stars rise and become lightning, but cannot lose their form.
Does this Lord of the, they believe in the name of the Lord of the Spirits, does he have a name anywhere in here?
No, I've heard of it.
Well, it's in the name of the Lord of the Spirits.
But he's just told us that
people
lightning
at church
comes from
praying
stars.
In the name of God, and a name they don't know. I know, lightning comes from stars. It's a bizarre scientific anomaly that nobody knows about for some reason.
Like I said, this displays very primitive man trying to explain the world thinks.
Yeah.
And attributing every little thing to God.
I saw the foundations of the earth. And now I saw the storehouses where all the winds are stored. And the stars creating lightning, and the gates from which these stars come out, and heard them talking to one another, he saw the foundations of the earth. And I saw the cornerstones of the earth, which means it's a square, flat thing. And I saw four winds which support the earth and the sky.
Yeah, winds hold the earth in the air. Oh, boy.
Yeah, I like how much you look at these there. Obey. How often
and
do
I went
you
towards
see
the south,
obey
and
forest?
It was burning day and night. I went to the south, and it was burning day and night. And there were seven mountains of precious stones, three towards the east and three towards the south. And those towards the east were colored stone. One was a pearl, one was a healing stone, and the other towards the south of redstone. And the middle of one reached to the heaven, like the throne of the Lord. The top of it was like, the top of it was sapphire.
Yeah, plus we all know that when you're out, looking for pearls, you're not really, like free diving in the ocean or anything. You go to mountains, and that's where you find
that a pearl, which is made in an oyster. Which is a shellfish that exists in the oceans. Rather than that's where pearl comes from, it actually is. There's a mountain made of it. Can you imagine?
Right here in Texas, you can get at some restaurants what are known as Rocky Mountain oysters.
Yeah, you can.
But I don't think you're going to find very many pearls in those.
No, nor would you find a mountain made of them.
Nor one made of sapphire, by the way.
Well, the one with the tip of sapphire reached to the heaven. The tallest mountain on Earth is Everest, and we've had people climb to the top of Everest, and I don't remember hearing reports of sapphires everywhere. I think there'd be more people clamoring to get up there if there were, though.
You know, when Yahweh in Yeshaya, chapter 1, and he's talking about us quarreling with, the Hebrew word is rib, and it's and you'll find that every English translation changes rib to plead with, and then it's amana, which is translated widow, but aman means those who are being religious, those who are dumb and deaf, and that are bound together. It's talking about the congregation of worshipers. And rib doesn't just mean contend with, quarrel with. It means to mock, to ridicule. And I think God does want us to ridicule this kind of rubbish, to mock it.
Oh,
just
yeah.
Just as we're doing. Mock it, ridicule.
Oh, I mean, it's just goofy.
But it's the only way you can get through it.
And if somebody wants to present the Enoch calendar, I'm going to mock them. I'm going to just say, you're an absolute nincompoop. For you to believe that Enoch was divinely inspired, you have to be an ignorant nincompoop. Now, ridicule them, mock them.
I do. I've thrown two out of Unpopular Truth over it, bringing in the book of Enoch. I tell them you're goofy, you're stupid. You must be mentally retarded. In fact, that's an insult to the people that have gone full retard because you're below a moron. You're an idiot.
Yeah.
On a scientific scale, you have to be a complete idiot.
People, you have to either be ignorant or just stupid.
Yeah.
It's one or the other. Either you don't know, you're either ignorant or you're irrational.
It's just mind-boggling that anybody would. I can see how a religious person, because you look at the humanity circa 200 BCE, really through probably 500 CE, you could sell them any pagan myth, and most people bought it. So does this sound any different than Greek mythology or Roman mythology or Babylonian mythology or Egyptian mythology or even in the 7th century CE with the Quran, with Quranic mythology? No,
it all sounds the same. Yeah.
Right.
Nothing real about any of it. I mean, when you opened the show, you were talking about how Yahweh's words, held true to the past. Well, what Craig was referring to there is things like the flood, where now we know that in Noah's lifetime we had the Burkle crater, as it's come to known, because he discovered it, hit out there off the coast of India, and that's what caused the flood, and he said he started it with deep ocean water. How strange is that, that all lines up perfectly with the Torah?
Right.
You know, I'm not some idiot that I was raised an atheist. I might have been raised by people that believe in magic, but I don't believe in magic. I understood there had to be a creator. And you know, he proves himself with all these things he says, like the 6 days of creation, and we all know now because of relativity, from the perspective of the creation, it took 6 24-hour periods of time, which is roughly 14.5 billion years, our time. Now, wow, what a coincidence is that? So unless you believe in incredible coincidences, Yahweh proves himself with science. Actual science,
yes,
in his words, not with storehouses full of wind and gates that stars come out of. This is religious rubbish. I'll stop there.
Yeah, it is. It's religious rubbish, and it's a darn shame that so many people today are still fooled by it. But, you know, there are people today who believe the earth is flat. There are people today that believe that the earth is 6,000 years old. And as people today, they evidently think that their God is stupid, but that you ought to believe him nonetheless. Let's worship a stupid God. Let's believe that which is clearly wrong.
Yeah, and this book was pushing worship. Let me ask you guys something. Does Yahweh promote worship?
Never. No, in fact, let's just say that he did. Would he be worth knowing?
No, he wouldn't.
No, can you imagine if Larry, you were so insecure that you created a new life form whose express purpose was to worship you? You would be disgusted.
Well, how stupid would that be? I you might do that as a joke. I mean, as a joke.
Yeah. And if the joke actually lived and it started worshiping you, how long would it take before you would be just absolutely disgusted by it?
Well, I mean, look, you know, Craig, not many of us have owned a $3 billion company nor had, you know, really thousands of people working for us. You have. Let me ask you this. How does it feel to walk down the hallway of, say, some corporate office and everybody you see kiss your ass all day?
Hated it. Despised it.
It's not even real.
You've seen how I respond when somebody gives me a compliment. You know, thanks me for writing something, this, that, and the other. I hate it.
Sometimes the compliments do, but just at the same time,
the natural response is to dislike it. And
yeah, what if we put you in
the
corporation?
Would want us to compliment him and worship him and praise him? You know. Have a worship service. It's just get real.
That's pretty weak.
I'm really fond when somebody writes and says, I really appreciated that insight. That was, the insight of the fact that the Bayreuth covenant is based on Bayreuth family, and that there are five terms and conditions, and here they are in the order they were presented, and five benefits and. And each one of them has a prerequisite and four other aspects, and it's kind of like the very, like our hand is a way to remember what these things are. You know, somebody says, that's a pretty interesting insight. Great, I'm with you.
But at the same time, if somebody was to lock you in, say, this ivory tower corporate hallway for all eternity, And as you walked down this hallway, everybody came out and said, "Good morning, Craig." And they had, inappropriate affect plastered all over the front of their face in the form of a smile at 7:30 in the morning. Wouldn't you just throw up at the end of, say, a couple of days of it? I mean, how much of it could you stand?
I'd make it to lunch.
I'm not sure I'd make it to lunch.
Yeah, I'm just saying, this is the position that these idiots who have never even considered that there's a creator reaching down saying, "Look, I want to meet you, but I want you to be a thoughtful person." I sit down with my grandson here. I sat down with my grandson, who is 10 years old, and I showed him where Yahweh wants to be greeted as an individual. And, you know, Dane looked at me. This was yesterday. Dane looked at me, and he goes, like one of the guys. And I said, exactly, Dane.
Yeah.
I said, exactly.
You know,
and you know who looked at me? And you know what Dane said to me? You know what he said to me? He said, you're smart. I said, well, no, I'm not that smart. I said, but this is what he says. And I'm willing to take his word for it over some man's word for it. He said, that's smart.
I get it. Yeah, smart.
And he said it very,
you know,
just straight up. A 10-year-old could get that.
Right. And Yahshua actually says, let's go take, please, let's go take a walk together and let's have a reasoned, rational conversation.
That's huge.
Yeah,
that's huge.
That's
like
I want to
kind
of do stuff together. I want to explore together. I want to chat together. I want our conversation to be reasonable, rational. It's not reasonable and rational to tell somebody, "Oh, you're so wonderful. I love you so much. Oh, God, you're just so neat. I praise you." Come on, that's not a reasonable or rational discussion.
If any one of us walked in our home and our children, I've got four, but say one of our kids or two of our kids were in the living room and they were bowed down with some kind of damn prayer shawl over their head, saying, "Oh, dear God, dear Dad,
Lord of my home,
$300 to meet my rent payment, you know, or something like that.
Get out of my house."
Yeah. You know, I'd pay the rent for them, and then I'd check them into a mental institution, you know, because I couldn't take it. I don't think anybody could take it. And that's what Satan and his little minions have done with their goddamn copy edits in the religious books that have taken what's real and turned it into a magic show. A magic show, which is what the Book of Enoch is. A magic show. Just
no better show.
You don't even have to copy edit this.
Incredible.
It's just pure trash. It's just pure trash. They don't even have to copy edit this. It's just stupid from start to finish.
Agreed. Yep. All right. I think we didn't get to the end of your presentation, JB, but I think we covered it.
It's kind of like questioning Paul. I went overboard with plenty of proofs. I went ahead and pasted the document in the chat room, so if anyone wants to read it, it's there, and then I'm going to put it on the forum as well.
Perfect, because we did, there were some marvelous other things, like 24-1. From there I went to another place on Earth, and he showed me a mountain of fire that blazed day and night. Yeah, I'd like to find where that one is.
Mount Kilauea.
We can create an infinity with that.
Night and day, and night and day forever.
Yeah, that's a problem. That's a problem. You know, and you know, the only other thing is they want to go, "Hey, well, sorry, that was in the Dead Sea Scrolls. I've had them." And I say, you know, there's all kinds of stuff in the Dead Sea Scrolls. There's songs in the Dead Sea Scrolls. There's economic information in the Dead Sea Scrolls. There's all kinds of things that aren't scripture in the Dead Sea Scrolls.
The majority of what was found there is useless.
Right. The effect of the longest scroll is the Temple Scroll. And the Temple Scroll is actually well crafted. I mean, it has some insights in it. You say, "Oh, well, that's interesting." The largest scroll in it, there's nobody on Earth that claims is should be added to the canon, and it's the longest one there. It's, you know, it's all about the Teacher of Righteousness, and it's called the Temple Scroll. You know, that's one of the things we have to be really careful on the Dead Sea Scrolls. The Dead Sea Scrolls were copied by a group of rabbis known as Essenes. And they were a group that was vying for power and had been ostracized by the Sadducees and the Pharisees. And so they were out there in the little community because they were outcasts. And so they had their own, they were very, very religious.
Wayne Mitchell just hit me up. He says he's been in Latrobe, Pennsylvania many times.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he's listening to the show. Airport.
Yeah, there you go. I mean, it's just, this is just, this is so bizarre. And I'm really thankful that you took the time to do this, James. You got to wade through a lot of trash to do this. You know, it's a hard thing to do, so.
But what it does is...
Well, you have to have a sense of humor when you do it.
We use simply evidence and reason to negate the theory of the Lunar Shabbat and the Enochian calendar, because it does not make sense. There's no way you can make sense of it. But to know that the book in which it is presented is complete rubbish... now you don't even have to entertain it. You just mock it and ridicule it and move on.
Yeah.
The moment they mention it,
nobody has
to
guess. Yeah, I mean, nobody has to guess. I mean, is it, you know, I could say that, you know, that I know Lioness, you know, and who's that? Well, you know, you've seen him. He's the Peanuts character. You've seen him. I know him. I've met him. I've talked to him. It would be every bit as valid. I mean, it's just weirdness. And why people have to, what it is, and I've talked to a number of people that agree, there are people out there, believe it or not, that don't understand there's so much to learn in the Torah and the prophets and the Nabi and the Mizmor. I just try and say it like that. There's so much to learn that, you know, in a lifetime you can't learn it all. It's beautiful learning. It's incredible story. It's all fits together perfectly, but there are a group of people that need to have secrets.
Now, I do think there are lots of secrets in the Torah prophets and Psalms and the Torah Nabi and Mizmor.
We unlock them daily.
But they're only secrets because people don't spend the time to uncover them. And it's, you know, for 99.999% of the world, it's a secret how to pronounce Yahweh's name. But if you spend any time at it, you uncover the secret and know it. So there are lots of secrets, but they're only secrets because most people are blind.
It was like looking when we first discovered that, you know, the way Yahweh said he would, you know, World War III was going to kick off was with Damascus being destroyed. And here it was the front page news every day.
Right, right.
And how it was going to come about. And then we could find out that's exactly how it's coming about. You know, and we're sitting here watching prophecy, you know, just unveil itself right before our eyes. I mean, remember that was a big deal.
Right.
It still is a big deal.
Still is a big deal.
But and when you start looking at these things and understanding these things and you share these things with others, to me, the only surprising thing about it is they don't get it, nor do they care to get it. They just don't even care.
Yeah, I think there's a lifetime, literally an eternity of learning in the Torah, prophets, and Psalms. So why would you want to
need secrets,
apocrypha material? Anything that isn't obviously from Yahweh. Yahweh is so clear. His story is so clear. He's so consistent. It's so obvious what is from it. Like, for example, I am not going to consider the Song of Solomon or Ecclesiastes. No reason. It's so different than the rest of the text. No interest in it. It's going to take a lifetime just to translate the first quarter of Isaiah. Why would I want to try?
I got more than enough to keep me busy.
More than enough. Yeah, more than enough.
Let me share something before everybody goes home. This is really cool. We were very fortunate last night to join a Skype group. And we met three New Covenant members from Canada. And I tell you, there's a new Larry in town. These young guys and one lady, one of their mothers, they discovered us, or not me so, but the yada yada and stuff, read everything, was so turned on by it. It was so thrilling to remember how enthusiastic we all were. when we didn't know anything to speak of, and we just went out to tell everybody immediately.
Yeah.
They went to the Seventh-day Adventist Church and told them, you know, you guys got it wrong. You need to talk about the Moe and Mikre. Of course, they were thrown out. And the Jehovah's Witnesses tried to beat them up in the parking lot. But these guys are on fire, man. It was just...
threw them out with pitchforks, huh?
Yeah, it was funny.
I'm actually more enthusiastic now than I was 15 years ago.
Well, I know. But, you know, that thing when you didn't really, you just...
Yeah, the difference
to everybody,
is that
you know, before you learn how to even
now.
Talk to somebody.
Yeah, I'm not going to go into it.
That was very much like
me. Right, yeah, I wouldn't do any of that today.
No.
My enthusiasm for it is greater than it was 15 years ago. It's just that, the difference is that
it was so new and fresh and everything.
Yeah,
it
is so spectacular and it makes so much sense that you think that if I share this, it will resonate with people, but it doesn't.
Exactly.
Yeah, because
I remember that
mindset first. God, in fact, in Isaiah, as I translate, he's constantly saying that you've got to walk away from religion. If you don't walk away from it and you approach it with an open mind, we're just not going to get anywhere.
Yeah, well, we had Alan Weed, and you unpopular today. He did a post that I guess some Jehovah's Witnesses came up on his porch and tried to gang save him right there. You know, and he ran him off. he ran him off.
Like the story you hear of people going to church and being picked up and baptized on stage in front of everyone. The matter of doing that's going to change anything.
It's just so, you know, I mean, there's a lot of bizarre thoughts out there that, and they all run contrary to the Torah, we know that. And it's just these apocryphal books, as you're calling them, we had to throw another nut out that somehow got into unpopular truth. This was the one that thought, well, could you only eat matzah for 7 days? Didn't even have any. Asking us such a stupid question as that. And at a feast, can you only eat matzah for 7 days? And then turn around and play teacher by using the book of the Gospel of Nicodemus. She was going to teach the people in unpopular. You know how that went over, like hand grenades. I mean, I'm just always amazed with people that don't want to know the Torah, but they want to learn everything but the Torah so they can have some secret that you don't know. And, of course, it's all based on nonsense. You know, it's just always nonsense. And
I really like matzah, but, you know, even when I'm eating matzah, I'm dipping it in olive oil.
Olive oil,
myself,
honey,
but, yeah. Right.
Or whatever.
And when I'm,
I got everything. I put peanut butter and there's cheese on it. It's good.
Yep.
Just good bread. I mean, just flat bread.
Wrap it up, piece of fried lamb in it, dip that in the olive oil, and take a big old bite.
I even put smoked gouda on it. I like that, too.
The first day that you eat unleavened bread, is there any other ingredient that goes along with it? What about the olive oil and the lamb? Is there any instruction not to eat lamb or any other food during the rest of the feast?
No, you're supposed to eat.
So why would somebody who didn't even know that come in and pretend to be a teacher? I mean, it's just nonsense. And what do they go? The apocryphal books. And this was another vegan, of course, you know, who refused to eat lamb.
There's a whole religiosity now on veganism.
Well, they need to get together with the Sasquatch people, and maybe they could start a dual movement or something like that.
Larry, I didn't quite finish your translation. I've been working on it since the other night when you sent it, so hopefully tomorrow I'll have a little...
I appreciate it. Terry did it. I wanted to see your take on it. You're going to love this one. You're going to love this one, Craig. This was... let me see, where's the actual original translation this guy had? I can't even find it now. It was so bad. It was a translation of a mizmor where you were getting on your worshiping God in his temple on your knees and so forth. It was, at your holy temple I will bow, and then he's got in parentheses, obediently, in reverence for you. And somebody asked me if that was real. I said, none of that's real. You know, the words bayeth, that means home. We know holy's not in there. We know you're not in there bowing at all.
Reverence is fine.
Reverence is okay.
Well, that's the only thing. And probably reverence in you is the only thing they have right. Okay? Yeah, I'm sure the rest of it's...
But by the way, none of that's, there's only one word, the last word, you, that's in the Dead Sea Scrolls, so everything is pretty much from the Masoretic, so I address that.
Yeah, and one of the things I find is that a lot of the times that you read worship or bow down in worship, the primary meaning of the word is to make a profession.
Declaration.
A declaration.
Shawa.
Yeah.
Yeah,
the primary definition.
Yeah, well, they have another word in there other than chawa. I forget what word they're using, but it's not chawa. They're using some other word. Now, Terry, when he did it, used chawa. So I don't, you know, we'll
yeah, see, you know, see. It's one of the places where I see the biggest discrepancy between lexicons when that happens to be the word where sometimes, you know, you'll find a passage and you'll look it up in the it will be referenced as one word in one place, and then, you know, the hard CH becomes the soft H in another place, and then it gives a different meaning, and so it's one of those things that is really slippery to track down.
And you get to the bottom line on it's Chawa, right?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, that has been my experience, but it's never been a fast thing. And it's tough to go back and validate what you've done just because of the fact that it's convoluted. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I've never seen a place where God has anyone worshiping him or bowing down to him other than he does have the leaders of the world in the great judgment bowing down with us standing around and them bowing down.
There's kind of a purpose, you know, for that one, though.
Yeah, you know, the key thing here is that that the primary, the best word that can be applied to a human is tzedakah. Dode was tzedakah.
Oh, right.
It is the best word that can be applied to a human, and it really only has two meanings, right and upright.
Hated and upright. Yeah.
Well, vindicated is a derivative of it. You know, if you're standing, you're vindicated after a trial, you're upright versus bowed down. So vindicated is a derivative of it. But the primary meaning of tzedakah is right and upright. And
yeah, right.
So this notion that he wants us to be bowed down, when the term that he applies to us, that the best possible term we could have applied to us is tzedakah, meaning upright.
Well, how are you going to walk and talk with somebody with your face in the dirt?
Yeah, when he says, come on, let's go take a walk together. Please, let's go take a walk together and have a rational conversation. And how are you going to do that when you're on your knees?
Yeah. I mean, the whole thing is absurd.
Yeah, he didn't say, come, bow down on your knees and worship me. He says, no, let's go take a walk and have a rational discussion. Yeah.
Well, I mean, that's undoubtedly Satan's shtick, you know, is to take, you know, when you've got so many places where Yahweh's saying, I will bend down to help you, I'm here to help you, you do this, I'm here for you, I will diminish myself and bend down.
Well, the beginning of Yahshayah, says, I reared you as children, I lifted you up. Lifted you up. And then you rejected me. It didn't say, I asked you to bow down, and you refused to do so. It says, I lifted you up, but then you rejected me.
It's the opposite. Everything's in the opposite in the religious world, because you're bowing
down. Why would God create a being to bow down to him? He would be sadistic.
Yeah. Well, he'd have ego problems, too. He'd have ego problems. He's just afraid. He'd just be afraid. Just another Mao Stalinist.
I do not want to spend eternity with a god that wants to be worshipped.
No.
I don't want to be
dead. Well, you'd be dealing with God. I'd rather be dead. Yeah, you'd be within insane madman.
The fact is, when we first see John face to face, we are going to be awestruck. I mean, we'll be.
Well, that's another issue, isn't it?
Well, that's never been chosen. It's not quite. Yeah.
We're going to be awestruck. And there's going to be a sense of, oh my goodness.
I've even said during the Teruah harvest, if I'm around, you know. Yeah, we know it's coming. Yeah, we've read about it. Yeah, we can see it.
Yeah.
I can show you 10 passages that say it.
Yeah.
And yet,
be blown away.
I would be shocked. Shocked. I mean, yeah, so yeah, of course, because I'm just a human. You know,
right.
I get that. You know, sure. But who in the world, I mean, they can't understand his majesty, his greatness, his intelligence, his power, just straight up awesomeness, if they would think that he wants us to bow to him. That, you know, that's the kowtow to Mao. Kowtow to Mao, right? I mean, that's where we're at in this thing. And that's how Satan would love the world to view God, to view Yahweh. He wants him to be asked backwards. He wants us to think of it in ass backwards terms. And that's
right.
Where religion comes in. It's Ha-Satan's shtick. I mean, that's what it's all about. I remember once we were on Shattering Myths, and I said something to that effect, and one of the callers that called in all the time said something to, how could you say that? And I said, well, if I'm not saying that, what are we even doing here? You know, because
the last thing I'd want to be is a troubadour for a god that wants to be worshipped.
Yeah.
I don't want to know him, so I'm certain heck not going to introduce anybody to him. He's not the god that I've come to know.
Yeah. Well, fortunately,
it's right. You know, he wants to be greeted as an individual. He wants us to walk with him and talk with him.
Yeah,
it worked for me.
Simple enough, right?
Yeah. Simple enough, grand enough. Yeah, it's still pretty cool. You know, the creator of the universe wants to go take a walk with you. Wants to talk with you.
Yeah. That's a little.
Yeah, it works for me. Yeah. Still gonna give him a hell about the platypus, but all fair game. Mm-hmm. All right, well, guys. Thank
happy
you.
Shabbat.
It was fun. Oh, yeah, happy Shabbat. We'll return to Psalm 91 and conclude it next time. But it was good to get Enoch under our belt.
Yeah. Well done, JB.
Well done, JB. Yeah. Good night.
Night. You guys have a good one.